Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to the ALPS podcast. We are very, very pleased to be on day two of the Psychedelic Science Conference. And I am honored, and really, we are very honored to have an amazing guest. But before I present the guest, I'm going to present the two hosts that I have with me. Marco, how are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. Thanks a lot to you both, Federico, the organizer, and Rick, the conference speaker we just heard about.
Yes, so we have Rick Dublin, which is here. Frankly, you are the founder of MAPS. You are, let's say, the founder of the psychedelic renaissance. So my first question to you is, how are you?
Well, I walk around in a state of utter amazement these days. I never, ever would have predicted that there would be billions of dollars of investor money going into hundreds of for-profit psychedelic companies. Of course, I wish that it was billions of dollars of philanthropy going into nonprofit psychedelic companies, but still, it's kind of amazing the things that are happening and the way people who maybe decades ago were against what we're doing are now turning their minds around. And just to give you one example of that, why I'm sort of walking around in amazement, there was a woman, Rachel Neuer, who just wrote a book about MDMA called I Feel Love. And for this book, she wanted to interview some of the people that were from the DEA in the 80s who tried to criminalize MDMA. So I said I would try to find them. And I found this one man, Frank Sapienza, that I had gone to multiple of the hearings. And he was the representative of the DEA at the hearings. Well, it turns out that I found him on LinkedIn, and he's no longer at the DEA, but he consults for pharma companies when they want to reschedule drugs. And so I wrote him a message. I said, we haven't talked for 35 years. And when you were trying to criminalize ecstasy, you admitted that you didn't know that it was used as a therapy drug. So you weren't really trying to stop the therapy. We knew that, but that's what happened anyway. So I said, now we've made all this progress. Would you be willing to speak to this reporter? And also, would you be willing to join our team as a consultant to help us in our negotiations with FDA and DEA to reschedule MDMA? And the very next day, he wrote me back and said, yes, I remember, and I'd be glad to help you. And this was after not talking for 35 years. So there's a lot of that kind of amazing long-term stuff that's turning around that's amazing.
Can you say one thing which you thought made the difference between this criminalization and where we are now? Is there one thing? Or
yes, there is one thing. And it was in 1992, and it was the FDA. And the FDA had blocked research for decades with psychedelics, and psychedelic research had been blocked pretty much all over the world as well in the reaction to the psychedelic 60s. And so because of the AIDS community, so AIDS was terrible in the 80s, and there was a group called ACT UP, which mm-hmm. was really protesting the fact that the FDA was very slow to approve drugs, and they felt that they were overly worried about risks, but they weren't looking at a dire need that, you know, people had this fatal illness and that they weren't looking enough at benefits. And so ACT UP did a demonstration, and they actually shut down the FDA building, which shocked the FDA. So they created a new group in response called the Pilot Drug Evaluation Staff to pilot test new ways to evaluate drugs that might be faster. This was created in 1990. And we had applied to do MDMA research since I started MAPS in 86, and it was we had all these protocols rejected. In 1990, they approved Rick Strassman to do a study with DMT, but it was looking in a negative way, sort of could more DMT in your brain cause schizophrenia or something, funded in part by the schizophrenia organizations. And so in 1992, the FDA said they have to have a meeting, a formal meeting, should they open the door to therapy research with psychedelics, looking at the benefits, not just the risks. And that meeting went great, and the FDA did decide that they would open up research, and then they gave us permission for the first study with MDMA. So I think if we look back mm-hmm. on what is the key moment for the psychedelic renaissance now, it's the FDA in 1992 saying, we're done with prohibition of psychedelic research, regardless of the science. It's been the politics to suppress this research, and we're not going to do that anymore.
Very nice.
So back to Geneva, Switzerland, when yeah. we are live from the ALPS conference 2023. Could you remind us what was the importance of Switzerland in 1986 when you founded the MAPS Association?
Yes. Well, let me go back just 1 year to 1985. So, you know, I had developed an interesting relationship with Robert Mueller, who was the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. And he had written this book called New Genesis, Shaping a Global Spirituality. And he talked about this importance of us understanding we're all in it together. He had a picture of the Earth from space. And I wrote to him and I said, I totally agree with your theories, with your emphasis on global spirituality, but you don't say anything about psychedelics. You know, would you be willing to learn about psychedelics and open up the door to psychedelic research? And he wrote me back, which shocked me, and recommended that I contact Vanya Palmers and others. So I, you know, met Vanya in 83. Then in 84, the DEA moved to criminalize MDMA, and then, you know, we were suing them, and the court case was going well, and then I became clear that the DEA was trying to criminalize MDMA internationally through the WHO, and then they would say, oh, now we have to follow suit because of our treaty obligation. So Robert Mueller, the Assistant Secretary of the UN, set up an appointment for me here in Geneva. So in 85, I came here and met with the expert committee that was working on it and presented them information. And actually, they criminalized MDMA, but they had a footnote. And the footnote was that the chairman, which was ironically Stan Groff's brother, Paul Groff, was the chairman of this committee. And everybody voted to criminalize except for him. And the footnote said that they were worried that this criminalization would slow down research and that they should be encouraging the nations of the world to facilitate this important research. So nothing really came of that until around 1988. So in 86, you know, this again being the home of Albert Hofmann and the discovery of LSD and the synthesis of psilocybin, but it was really 88 when the Swiss psychiatrist got approval, in part because of this footnote, that they then got permission to start working with MDMA and LSD with their patients. This was SAP, the Swiss group. And so that was exciting for us, that somewhere in the world there was this opportunity that was legal. And Peter Gasser eventually wrote a paper about this that sort of spread that word. And then we would start coming here for various meetings to be where actually psychedelic research was happening, even though it was suppressed in the United States. So Switzerland was really the pioneering place. And from a symbolic way of the psychedelic renaissance, there were two main things that I felt we had to do from a sort of social, global, political, symbolic means to really have a psychedelic renaissance. The first was that we had to start research at Harvard again, because that's where Timothy Leary was.
Good thing.
And the second one is we had to start LSD research, because that was the quintessential bad psychedelic. And so we were able, with Peter Gasser, in 2008, to start LSD research for the first time here in Switzerland. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that that happened several months before Albert Hofmann died, so that he could see the opening of LSD research. And Anita, also his wife, saw that before she died, a few months before he died. Then the other was this, again, psychedelic research at Harvard. And so that was 2006, 2007, and that was also MDMA, but it was for cancer patients with anxiety. So Switzerland has been an inspiration for us. And also the training programs that they have here for therapists are unparalleled, because they involve being able to give people MDMA, psilocybin, ketamine, LSD. The way in which compassionate use is available for psychiatrists and therapists to work with a range of patients with a range of different psychedelics, it's leading the world here in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. That's very good. And everybody should go check out also the Alps conference that you just did. It's going to be on YouTube. You were speaking at this conference about MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, and it's a phase 3 trial, so it's nearly going to be finished. Can you say a few words on that and where it's gone? Do you think it's going to be in next year?
Yeah. So we've finished phase 3.
Yes.
You know, basically, it took us from 1992 through the 90s to do the phase 1. Then phase 2 was 2000 to 2016, where you figure out how to design phase 3. Phase 3 was 2018, and we finished it in 2023. And we have two successful phase 3 studies, and we will be submitting data to the FDA the first half of December. And then we're hopeful by around June or the mid-2024 that we will, if all goes well, have FDA approval.
Wow. That's great. And because you were also explaining during the conference that you also have views for the future after 2024 for that, what are they?
Well, the most important one after FDA is to come to Europe to really get approval from the European Medicines Agency and England from MHRA.
And does that need new studies, or it's going to be able? They're going to be able to.
Well, that is still to be determined. Okay. So the MHRA. You know, England, I think, made a disastrous move, which was Brexit, you know, right around the time we made a disastrous move in America, which was to elect President Trump in these isolationist attitudes. And so the MHRA you know, the European Medicines Agency used to be in London, now they're in Amsterdam. So the MHRA doesn't have enough resources to really fully review drugs the way they did before. And so they're thinking about just saying if FDA approval happens, then that might be enough for MHRA. I'm not sure if the EMA would also want us to do additional studies. We have done some small studies in the Netherlands and the Czech Republic, but these are just small number of subjects. So we will see if we do have FDA approval, then what will be required of us from EMA.
Yeah, I think last year, Federico, we had somebody from the Santé Suisse that was saying that normally they would rely on the phase 3 trial from the US. So hopefully it's going to be.
Yeah, it was the Federal Office of Public Health. Yes. And of course, it's a systemic endeavor, so it will work out also for other countries.
So what would it actually mean here then in Switzerland? So now you've got a small, relatively small group of psychiatrists that can do this work. If it gets, if FDA says yes, then how do you imagine it would be regulated here in Switzerland?
It's very difficult to predict. In any case, I don't think I have the means to really imagine this. And in any case, I guess one idea would be to regulate it as a form of psychotherapy. Because in Switzerland, we have really very good regularization and formalization of psychotherapy training and schools. So in that sense, you would really have to create educational proposals for people like at the level of the postgraduate education.
Okay, just to say that once we, if we do get FDA approval, we want the therapists that work to be only those that have been through a training program in the method that we've used in phase 3. We want them to understand that. But once we've determined that they understand that, then when they practice, they don't have to stick with that. Okay. They can add other techniques that they like if they want to do guided imagery or they want to add meditation or any kind of different thing to it. That will be up to the therapist. But we want them to have a minimum set of understandings of the work that went into the phase 3 and the successful studies. And then they can innovate or add.
Yeah, and maybe we should copy the American model because you were also showing that you think you will be able to have by 2030 25,000 therapists.
Well, this is our aspirational goal, but I think it's really very possible. But we have three parts of the training program. The first part is like a 6 days in person, around 50 people, going over videotapes of therapy sessions, our treatment approach, our what are called adherence criteria. Second part, which is difficult, and hopefully we can do more here in Switzerland, which is therapists receiving their own experiences with psychedelics in a therapeutic context. And then the third part of the training is where therapists work with their first patients, and it's all videotaped, and then we have the videotapes reviewed by our what are called adherence raters, and then supervisors speak back to the therapists about little tips. And then again, once we know that they're understand the method we've used, then they're on their own.
Yeah. And with 25,000 therapists, how many do you think how many persons could you treat?
Well, again, it's 42 hours of therapy.
Yeah.
And we do use a 2-person team. So we guess that a team could maybe do, and we have a 3 MDMA sessions and a lot of prep and integration sessions. So we think a team could maybe do 30 people a year, something like that. Now, again, we're not talking about group therapy yet. That's going to be the big dynamic that may change everything. But, you know, 30 people per year. And so, you know, that's roughly maybe 500,000 people if we get to that point per year. And then we will see what happens with group therapy.
Maybe one question to both of you guys, Federico and Rick.